It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Last year, hundreds of kids around the United States suffered from lead poisoning after eating cinnamon applesauce that was tainted with dangerous levels of lead. Food safety advocates say this shows a major gap in the Food and Drug Administration's authority to effectively oversee food safety. The U.S. government estimates that there are about 48 million cases of foodborne illness annually. Our next guest has spent the last 30 years advocating for greater protections in the food safety system. He joins us now for a look at some of the recent recalls and outbreaks and how they fit into the bigger picture of food safety. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or your kids ever gotten sick from something you ate? Did that product end up getting recalled? How do you keep track of what foods have been recalled? Do you not know how to find out? Do you have questions about our food safety system in the country? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Bill Marler is a personal injury lawyer and longtime food safety advocate. He's the managing partner of Marler Clark, a law firm based in Seattle that specializes in foodborne illness cases. He was featured in the recent Netflix documentary Poisoned, The Dirty Truth About Your Food. Bill, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hello.
Before we get into wider concerns about the food safety system, let's zoom in on this story of lead in cinnamon applesauce marketed to kids. How did it find its way into the system? Why wasn't it detected before it was already affecting kids?
So it's pretty clear that, and I think the FDA is correct, that there was intentional contamination, likely added lead powder at some point in the chain of distribution to increase the weight of the cinnamon. Now, that sounds, I know, just crazy, but intentional adulteration occurs like that, unfortunately, too frequently. There was an outbreak of melamine, which is a plastic substitute in dog food and cat food, about 15 years ago, that sickened thousands and thousands of pets across the United States. And melamine was added to the mixture because it faked protein. And so when you chemically tested melamine, it registered as protein. So they were, in a sense, juicing the cat and dog food, but it was causing kidney failure in animals. So these things do happen. And they really are a failure of, you know, this chain of distribution that may stretch across the world. There are difficult points when the FDA doesn't have control over what goes in to a food product. They rely on, you know, importers primarily and exporters to do the right thing. But the melamine in the dog food and the lead in the cinnamon, you know, escape that scrutiny.
Yeah, both those cases are, as you mentioned, part of the international food distribution system. In the case of the cinnamon, I believe it came from South Asia via applesauce products in Central or South America. The assumption, right, I think a lot of consumers might have is no big deal. The FDA or somebody is testing or at least sampling this stuff as it gets imported to make sure it meets our standards. What actually happens?
Well, you know, in the lead in the cinnamon, there likely was, you know, we don't know for sure yet. That's going to be figured out in the litigation. But they'll, you know, my strong suspicion is that there was a failure to test or falsification of testing at, you know, the point where most importers require what's called certificates of analysis, so some testing. It's likely that somebody either didn't test or they faked the test results. And that's how the lead made it through the system into the cinnamon and then into the applesauce. But, you know, as we chase cheaper and cheaper products around the world, making these products less, you know, less costly to people, but the risks of extending a supply chain around the world means there's potential for, you know, gaps, especially if it's intentional.
And this applesauce, as I mentioned, we didn't find out about it until, in this case, actually, it was two parents in North Carolina. They were worried about their kids' blood lead levels after routine screening. How often is this the case that whether we're talking about a mineral adulterant like lead versus a foodborne illness like E. coli, how common is it that we don't find out about the contamination until it's already affecting people?
Yeah, that's a super point. Our system is really set up that it's the canary in the coal mine scenario. You know, whether it be lead in cinnamon that gets into applesauce, or, you know, bacteria in infant formula, E. coli in hamburger or romaine lettuce. The way the system operates now is that it's usually when people get sick that we notice. You know, lead took a longer time because it's not a what you'd normally expect to find in a child's type product. But E. coli cases, salmonella cases, listeria cases, the ones you hear about, what happens is once somebody consumes a product and gets sick, they go to the hospital, they test positive for the product. That's when health authorities are notified, and that's when they start to do their investigation. So in many respects, the horse is already out of the barn making people sick. They do jump on those cases fairly rapidly and fairly quickly with the idea of trying to figure out what is the common food item and then to get that product off the shelf as fast as possible. But in most of these instances, by the time the illnesses are being counted, the outbreak is either coming to an end or already over.
Bill Marler is with us, personal injury lawyer, longtime food safety advocate, looking at the American food safety system after one of the most recent incidents, lead contaminating cinnamon found in applesauce and other products. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your experiences as a consumer, if you've had a foodborne illness yourself, or if you're in the food production system, do you see ways to make it safer? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Chris is with us in Eau Claire. Chris, hi.
Hi. So I have heard some suggest that perhaps separating the food part of the FDA from the drug part of the FDA to make the food safety program more robust and to give the program more bite when it says that something needs to be done. Does this sound like a reasonable assertion? And if so, what can we do moving forward to help the FDA do a better job?
Chris, thanks for the call. Bill, what do you think?
Brilliant idea. And it's actually been one that I've advocated for over 30 years. There have been multiple times where Congress has sort of stepped into that to try to figure out whether or not we can create a food safety system that really sort of deals not only with bacterial and viral contaminations, but also human nutrition. The way the food system was set up, where the USDA, which has an arm called Food Safety Inspection Service that oversees essentially red meat, chicken, pork, and poultry. That's what they oversee. And they also oversee catfish. The FDA does all other fish and everything else in the food supply, so about 80%. The problem that the FDA has is that their bulk of their resources go to, you know, overseeing drugs and medical devices, which is a good thing because we want to make sure those are safe. But the food side of the equation at FDA, you know, does take, you know, the back seat. Some people call it the red-haired stepchild of the food system, and it's really true. You know, I think most people who would be building a food system, and the way you see systems built in the EU, is that there's a food safety agency that has all the pieces. It has meat, it has poultry, it has, you know, consumer goods, all of that's involved with human nutrition, and it's overseen in a robust way. We're pretty disjointed here in the United States, and it's not the best system that allows for, you know, a real close look at our food system.
Chris, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Bill Marler, food safety advocate, managing partner of Marler Clark, a law firm that specializes in foodborne illness cases. He's with us for a look at the food safety system and what happens when contaminated food makes its way into grocery stores and on into our pantries. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you, by and large, trust the safety of the U.S. food system? Do you have concerns? How often do you think food should be tested for things like toxins and pathogens? What questions do you have about foodborne illness and the food safety system? Do you work in food production, maybe here in Wisconsin? Love to hear your perspective as well. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with longtime food safety advocate and legal expert Bill Marler about the recent lead poisoning outbreak from contaminated cinnamon applesauce and ways to improve the food safety system. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction when you hear about food recalls or this lead contamination or outbreaks of E. coli or salmonella in the news? Has one of these ever affected you? I got salmonella once, never sure where it came from. Wasn't fun. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Bill, related to what I just said there, I once had salmonella. I have my suspects, but I never found out where it came from. How often do you think it is that there might be some contaminated food that it doesn't end up being enough of an outbreak to show up on the radar?
There is a great statistic that the CDC puts out that for every one person who's counted in a salmonella outbreak, and counted means that they got sick and they sought medical attention and there's a culture that's positive for salmonella, for every one person counted, there's 38.5 other people who don't get counted. So most of the time when you hear about a foodborne illness outbreak linked to a particular product or a restaurant, you're really just seeing the tip of the iceberg of the people who are sick. 1.3 to 1.4 million Americans get salmonella every year, but it's just really a handful of those that are testing positive. And so the system is really not really well designed to catch these outbreaks before they cause illness. I've been a big advocate of being much more proactive. So to really require importers, manufacturers, have a food safety culture that also involves, high grade technology to eliminate pathogens and also, random testing. E. coli 0157 used to be called the hamburger disease. 25, 30 years ago, that was all I did. But a combination of, in regulation from the government, intervention from, manufacturers, increased cook times at restaurants, it's essentially eliminated E. coli from hamburger. Doesn't mean that people should go out and eat raw hamburger or what you call in Wisconsin tiger meat. I would not advocate for that. But hamburger is much safer in 2024 than it was in 1994.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. Your guest mentioned about 15 years ago, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, melamine in dog food. Actually, at that time, I lived in the state of Oregon, and the big issue there, I thought it was nationally, was that that chemical was also added to baby formula. And that was a big issue. Also, and they were the baby formulas that came from China. Also, there were some pasta products. I recall one that I had. It was organic, but no one could tell if it had melamine in it or not.
Tom, thanks for the call. Bill, I know that was a story you were following at the time.
Yeah, no, the infant formula one primarily impacted children in China. In fact, I was in China speaking in Beijing at a food safety conference when that story broke and was asked not to speak about it, which was probably the wrong thing for somebody to ask me to do. So I spoke about it anyway. And then as I was leaving Beijing in the airport, I got pulled aside, had a little discussion with some Chinese officials, but I did make my plane.
Tom, thanks a lot for the call. Marcus joins us now in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hey, Rob. So I think there's a real opportunity for all of us, just given everything that's going on with the climate, to perhaps shorten up the chain of custody for some of our food and start looking to grow perhaps, you know, strawberries, raspberries, whatever, tomatoes in the backyard. And so that way it's, you know, readily available and we're able to check, you know, the cleanliness of it as it makes it to our table. And just for what it's worth, I had cryptosporidium from water back in Milwaukee in the 80s.
Ooh, yeah, that was a huge, huge outbreak, Marcus.
That was a huge outbreak. Thanks. Hundreds of thousands of people sick. Yeah, that was a mess.
Marcus, thanks a lot for that call. Bill, Marcus's idea, not everybody's going to be able to grow all their own food, but his idea of shortening the food chain so we have a shorter chain of custody to track. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, I don't want to blame imported food products for all our, you know, woes because, you know, products that, you know, get grown in California get shipped around the country and they cause outbreaks. There was a spinach outbreak in 2006. The spinach went all over the United States, but most of the illnesses were in Minnesota, Ohio, and Wisconsin because that product was manufactured in California. It was chopped, triple washed, bagged, and shipped across the country. It went to California too, but there were hardly any illnesses, very few illnesses on the West Coast. But having that product shipped across the country, it takes a couple of days. That bacteria perks in that bag and, you know, creates enough E. coli to make people quite ill. So I think there's a pretty good reason to try to shrink these supply chains, you know, to make it so, you know, you're eating products that are fresher, that don't have a chance for that bacteria to manifest itself and to grow to an infectious level that'll make someone sick.
Marcus, thanks for that call. We're talking to Bill Marler, longtime food safety advocate, about the American food safety system. Bill, staying with the contaminated greens, talk about the systemic problems that might be there, the way the greens are grown, exposed to ultimately manure from livestock, and that gap in regulations that might make it harder for the food safety system to catch that.
Yeah, the FDA has been frustratingly slow at really dealing with environmental contamination. And a lot of it has to do with even some of the earlier discussions we were having about having this sort of disjointed food supply where you have USDA paying attention to this and FDA paying attention to that. I mean, I think it'll shock your listeners to understand that when there is an outbreak of E. coli linked to leafy greens, like the 2018 outbreak that sickened 240 people in the U.S. and many in Canada as well, it was linked to romaine grown in Yuma. It was, you know, close to a cattle feedlot, close to a water supply that went past the cattle feedlot. There's no question that the outbreak stemmed from there, but because of the disjointed, you know, who's responsible, you know, FDA was not allowed to go onto that cattle feedlot to do testing to see, to confirm what I think, frankly, is evident that that was the source of the E. coli. So if you don't test, you don't know, you can't do anything about it. And the FDA has been tiptoeing around, you know, making environmental contaminant a reason why you can go onto a farm. But there's a bill now that has been put forward by Rosa DeLauro in the House and Senator Booker in the Senate that would actually allow for investigators to go on to these properties to determine what the source of the outbreak was.
Bill, I mentioned at the outset that documentary Poisoned that you were featured in. I can't remember if you said it or someone else, but somebody described the food safety system as a game of whack-a-mole in many ways. Okay, burger, we'll fix that. Lettuce, we'll tackle that. Lead now and cinnamon, we'll tackle that. Talk about the philosophy you'd like to see instead of that reactive approach.
Yeah, I mean, the Food Safety Modernization Act, which was passed in 2010, signed by President Obama, really tried to kind of deal with making food safety much more proactive, to push more responsibility onto manufacturers, importers, the supply chain, to really step up and, you know, make sure that the food that we're getting is safe. There's just continues to be gaps. And I think whack-a-mole is the right way to say it. I think that was my friend Darren Detweiler, who lost his child in the Jack in the Box case, that said that. But we really just need to do a better job of sort of dealing with these environmental contaminants and how to deal with, you know, land use issues of where you're growing, you know, ready to eat products like lettuce and, you know, spinach, and how close that can be to a cattle feedlot or cattle operations. We know that a lot of pathogens like Salmonella, E. coli, come from cattle, and we need to deal with that, and it's been a problem. We also know that Salmonella is a constant problem with chicken, but the USDA has not banned Salmonella from chicken like they banned E. coli from hamburgers. So there continues to be gaps in the system. We do have this tendency to, when there's a disaster, we do something and then we kind of, you know, fall back to paying little attention to it.
Bill, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Take care. Have a good rest of your day.
You too. That's Bill Marler, longtime food safety advocate, managing partner of Marler Clark. That's a law firm that specializes in foodborne illness cases. We've been talking about food safety in the U.S., why it's important to address gaps in the system after lead was found in cinnamon products, including cinnamon applesauce marketing to kids over the last year. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Smaller colleges and universities in Wisconsin are facing growing financial challenges, and some have closed down completely. Northland College in Ashland is currently trying to raise $12 million by April 3rd to keep its doors open. Last year, Cardinal Stritch University in Milwaukee closed down. A handful of the universities of Wisconsin two-year campuses have also closed or suspended in-person classes, most recently UW-Milwaukee at Waukesha and UW-Platteville at Richland. Declining enrollment is a big part of the problem. Higher education leaders around the state and country are looking for solutions to keep their classrooms open. We're taking a closer look at how colleges are navigating these issues and what options are available to try and solve them. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Did a campus in your community close recently, or is it in difficulty? What does it mean to have that campus where you live right now? Did you attend a smaller college? Big or small, or sorry, public or private. What did you think? Do you want to see more done to keep them open? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Doug Letterman is a co-founder and editor of the online publication Inside Higher Ed. Doug, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, we've got these examples here in Wisconsin. Are we alone in Wisconsin, or is this something going on elsewhere in the country?
Well, you're hardly alone. You are, I would say, the Midwest and the Northeast are probably the centers of this kind of activity for a variety of reasons. But we haven't done a full count, but there probably aren't very many states in the country that haven't seen at least one college close or merge. And I mean, when you think about it, there are 3,000 or 4,000 colleges in the country, and we have seen enrollment decline over the last decade by a million plus, from about 20, from close to 20 million down to 18 and a half or so. And, you know, the number of institutions is unlikely to stay constant when you see that kind of change. That's just one of the multiple factors that's happening. But you're hardly alone, but you're definitely in one of the zones where we're seeing more of this happen than elsewhere.
Each campus difficulty, I'm sure, has its unique elements, but do you see this overall trend, declining enrollment, being at the heart of most of these challenges?
I don't think there's any question that enrollment, changing demographics and changing behavior are a major factor. There are others. We have seen enrollment decline, as I said, probably going back about a decade. The peak was probably in the low, was it around 2010, when there were almost 21 million people enrolled in colleges and universities around the country. And since then, we've seen a decline. Then we saw it sort of a slow decline. And then we saw, obviously, a big shift during the pandemic. We saw about a million additional students kind of disappear and kind of fall off track. We've seen enrollment slowly recover since then. So, and that all was heading into what had been anticipated to be starting around the middle of this coming decade. We're expecting to see a further decline in the number of 18-year-olds. And this is basically what the baby boom echo, the people who in the mid-2000s and late 2000s, the recession, the big Great Recession of 2008, basically led to, as often happens, a decline in the number of children being born. And we're seeing the sort of echo of that happening now, where we're seeing over the next decade expecting a drop, different parts of the country, but a drop in the number of 18-year-olds. So all of this decline over the last decade and the pandemic stuff was leading into what was projected to be this sort of baby boom, you know, this sort of enrollment cliff, as people have called it. You layer on top of the enrollment issues a set of things, including a pretty significant, hard to measure, but pretty significant decline in people's confidence and in growing doubts about the value of getting a college degree, and changes in the behavior about how many people are willing to sort of take, whether it's 2 years at a community college or 4 years for a four-year degree, out of the workforce. So people are less inclined to go study full time. So all those factors are sort of swirling and contributing to this.
And Doug, I remember back after the Great Recession, you mentioned the year, I think 2010, as a peak for college enrollment, the idea that, hey, this recession, it tanked the economy, maybe there's no jobs out there. Guess I might as well go to school for a couple of few years, get some qualifications when things turn around. Now we've got this post-COVID situation where unemployment is lower, many more jobs than applicants in some cases. Is it just that simple that a better economy is hurting colleges?
100%. I mean, that's the thing. Higher education, as you just laid out very well, is what's called countercyclical, meaning when the economy is strong and there are jobs, people go get those jobs. And there's a, you know, listen, there's a set of kids. My kids were probably going to go to college almost no matter what, grew up in a middle class background. There are a lot of people who live on sort of a work slash school bubble, and they're going to make their decisions. That's especially true of adult learners, less true of sort of 18-year-olds, but there are some 18-year-olds whose families need them to go work. And so when the economy is good and coming out of the recession, as you said, there were manufacturing jobs, but lots of jobs that were paying bonuses for people to come and take a $500 signing bonus. And instead of what was a $13 an hour job, we're paying $20 an hour. So when the economy is strong, people make that choice, that set of people. And there's a few million people in that category. When the economy is less strong, people are going to, as you said, go get some more training. So that's another factor that is absolutely contributing to this problem. And basically the situation, what that leaves is a lot of institutions that have – arguably, there are plenty of places around the country where lots of colleges were able to keep filling their classes. And now with the sort of pool shrinking, that's part of why we're seeing seeing places close or merge. I'm glad. I mean, your introduction was really good at differentiating even though you described them as sort of small. So you're not talking about the University of Wisconsin at Madison, and which is going to, all the flagships are doing great generally now. They're winning the battle to the extent, but there are different kinds of institutions. So the sort of regional, the technical colleges that you described, the branch campuses of the publics, those mostly serve adults. The Richlands that you were talking about, those are the places that are being affected most by the work, the state of the economy, and the fact that there are good jobs for people who need jobs and want jobs. The Cardinal Stritches of the world are more affected by the sort of declines in the number of 18-year-olds and people starting to ask hard questions about, you know, is this $40,000 tuition going to pay off for me? So different problems, different sort of sets of these things affecting different types of institutions. But those are, there are very few institutions that are invulnerable to this, to the trends we're talking about here.
Talking to Doug Letterman from Inside Higher Ed about a lot of small campuses around Wisconsin, around the country, facing financial challenges, largely because of declining enrollment. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Josh is with us in Eau Claire. Josh, hello.
Hey, I work at UW-Eau Claire, and there your caller or your interviewer mentioned that the flagships are doing okay. So UW-Madison doesn't really have enrollment issues. They just open up the spigot a little bit more and accept more because they have 5,000 to 7,000 extra applicants every year than they accept. There's a guaranteed transfer program from the comprehensive, so the UW-Eau Claire, Stouts, Platteville's. If you start at 2 years at the comprehensive and you do well, you get a guaranteed transfer into Madison. And if Madison would help the comprehensives out by saying, instead of you're not accepted to Madison, you're accepted to Madison, but you're going to do your first 2 years at UW-Platteville. That would really help out the comprehensive and leverage us as a UW system rather than Madison on an island and all the comprehensives. You fight it out for whoever is left.
Josh, thanks. Thanks a lot for the call. Doug, Wisconsin's not the only state with that sort of flagship and other campus model. Texas and others have this. They don't always play together exactly like Josh wants them to.
Definitely not. And it's a great call and a phenomenon that we absolutely see around the country. And the tricky part, it is, you would like to think that people who run systems like what's now called the Universities of Wisconsin, they changed the name, would do that kind of sort of coordinating, it tends to be called, where you're saying, where you're making all the parts work well together. There are enormous differences in how much authority the different systems wield and how much they're willing to use it. Some of your listeners may be old enough to remember conversations probably about a decade ago about Madison sort of really flexing its muscles and really almost threatening to sort of leave the system. And that happened in some ways out in Oregon and in other places. So it is really trickier than you'd like to think it should be to get the institutions playing together. But that's the kind of logic that would absolutely make sense. And the students who are not getting accepted to Madison, I don't know enough about what's happening on the ground there, but it would be really smart for the system to say, you know, we're going to give you guaranteed admission rather than seeing those people rejected at Madison go to Indiana University or to pick your, or to the University of Minnesota or whatever. And so I think there's an opportunity for a lot of states to sort of be more, a little more aggressive to keep their regional campuses. Those comprehensive institutions that the caller from Eau Claire described are definitely vulnerable. They, along with a lot of the small privates, are struggling. And those are the institutions that probably those comprehensive institutions do the really heavy lifting in our post-secondary education ecosystem.
Thanks for that call. We're talking Inside Higher Ed co-founder and editor Doug Letterman about declining enrollment and financial challenges facing smaller colleges and universities in Wisconsin and beyond. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you attend or did you attend a smaller school, public or private? Do you want to see it stick around for a long time? What challenges do you see there? If you work on one of these campuses, love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Doug Letterman, co-founder and editor at Inside Higher Ed, looking at smaller colleges in Wisconsin, why some of them are closing or at risk, and some possible solutions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Doug, before we go back to our callers, I want to look at solutions. Have you seen examples of smaller colleges and universities finding ways to be sustainable with a smaller student count?
Yeah, I mean, this is what there's probably, I said before, there are three or 4,000 colleges in the country, depending on how you count. I would say there's probably, maybe there's 10% that don't have to worry about these issues at all. So that's, you know, 200-300 institutions probably. And everybody else is going to need in one way or another to change what they, how they operate to continue to fulfill their mission, but in an era when people are looking for somewhat different things and when potentially there are fewer students. But remember, one of the reasons, I mean, I talked before about the decline in the number of 18-year-olds. There are tens of millions of people in our society who have either tried college and it didn't quite work out for them the first time for all sorts of reasons. There are people, plenty of people who've never gone to college at all. There's about 35 to 40 million people who have what we call some college, no degree. And so one of the things that institutions are doing, and not just the community colleges and the regional publics that have had a history of serving adult learners, but even you see some small private colleges doing this, expanding who they consider to be their students. And so that's one change that we have seen is places saying, you know, we used to be a residential campus that served just 18-year-olds. We're going to have to add programs. We're going to have to add certificates. We're going to have to. So some of the changes involve changing the offerings, going into sort of not necessarily abandoning the four-year degree, but recognizing that fewer people probably are going to be looking for that full-time residential experience and are going to be wanting to do it alongside work. I mean, we know that already a significant proportion of students have to work to get through college. So some of the changes are around what the offerings are. Some of them are in how they offer it. And part of the problem that when you have fewer students, your cost structure doesn't necessarily shrink with it. And so one of the things we've seen lots of colleges go through and looking at their academic programs and deciding whether all of them are still viable, whether some of them are less effective and less efficient than they might be. We're seeing institutions collaborate with each other. There are course sharing platforms where a bunch of colleges will come together and around like languages, and not everybody will teach Chinese. There will be a group of institutions where some of them will teach Chinese courses and the others will teach German and some others will teach and they'll share the offering. So there's a lot of experimentation. There's this tendency to look at higher education as being static and unchanging. And there are certain things that are consistent, but I do think that it's kind of a myth that colleges don't change. Now, whether enough of them are going to adapt fast enough to stay alive and avoid the fates of the Cardinal Stritches and the Concordia, Wisconsin, another one that closed last year, is hard to say. But and obviously, we've seen a ton of experimentation with different ways of delivery, including online education. So there is a lot of experimentation, but these are institutions where roughly 75% of the costs are in people, one way or another, and it's going to be very hard for them to shrink without laying off people. I mean, your intro also talked about sort of the importance role of these institutions in the community and in their communities. A lot of the institutions, a lot of colleges are the biggest employers in their town or in their county. And so there's a tendency to want to keep them alive. And I think closing a college is hard and painful, but I think there will be a decent number that close.
I believe we still have some Concordia University in Wisconsin. There were some campus closures, though, along the way.
Right,
we still have our Mequon campus, at least. I know that because we've got a guest from there pretty often. Okay, back to our callers. Juliet is with us in Washburn. Juliet, hi.
Hi. I was just calling. I know we're running short on time, but I just wanted to say I was a non-traditional student at one of our two-year regional campuses, and I was because I was place-bound, and so I was able to obtain a phenomenal education there, and now I live in the community that's going to be affected tremendously by Northland's closure. I think that we should speak to not only your guest touched on how deep the economic component is of these universities and small communities, especially in northern Wisconsin, but I think there's a greater conversation to be had around the overall rhetoric in society over the last 20 years devaluing education and higher education primarily, and maybe we need higher education to be more assertive at what the value is. Obviously, the value has increased as funding has decreased from at the governmental level or federal level. But if your guest could speak to any of these components, that would be great. I'll keep my comments up here.
Juliet, thanks for the call. Doug.
Yeah, she made some very good points. There is no question, especially in the last 5 years, although you can go back longer to people like Scott Walker, who in your fair state, who definitely targeted higher education in certain ways as a sort of because it appealed to what he viewed as his some of the constituents he wanted. That's happened a lot when we've seen people run for higher offices. But there is no question we've seen public confidence in higher education decline. We've seen rhetoric criticizing higher education increase. And listen, some of the criticisms are fair. I mean, higher education is decreasingly affordable. We've seen there are some fair things that I think people want to see higher education respond to. There's absolutely also some really unfair critiques, and I think just wrong-headed critiques that are just part of our the politicization, increased politicization and partisanship in our society. But I think there's a lot of room for colleges and frankly for business leaders to step up and support the higher education institutions and the importance of higher education. When college leaders go and talk about how important their institutions are, they're seen as just another interest group in some ways. And so actually, I think the people who really need to be standing up and explaining the importance of higher education are the employers who are going to be hiring the graduates, who are moving into their businesses into communities where they want an educated community, so they should have good colleges and universities near there. I think we've seen a degradation in support for higher education, and I think there are a bunch of people who could step up and speak more on their behalf.
Thanks a lot for that call. We have just over a minute or so left, Doug. In our last minute or so, are there any demographic signs of good news for colleges and universities, or do they really have to adapt to this different present and future?
Well, I think, listen, as I said, I think probably the biggest, there is not in the near term a lot of good news on the demographic front if you're talking mostly about traditional age students. And again, this demographic, there's a wonderful economist named Nathan Graw up at Carleton College in your neighboring state who has focused on sort of what the demographics look like. The big opportunity is in what I would describe as kind of, we still call them non-traditional learners, even though in many ways they're the majority now, but of adult learners and veterans. And there are just tons of people who would benefit from having a higher education of some kind. And again, it may not be a degree. It may be that it's a certificate that gives them something to grab onto and that will help them get a job. So I think there's a lot of opportunity but I think it will require, the more traditional an institution is, it will require some adaptation. There are very few places I think that can afford to just keep doing what they're doing and continue to thrive. But I think there's plenty of opportunity to go out and reshape what a college offers and what services it provides students to keep functioning.
Doug, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure. Great to have. Thanks for having me.
That's Doug Lederman, co-founder and editor at Inside Higher Ed, with us today to look at the ways smaller colleges and universities are working to overcome declining enrollment and other financial issues. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, find out how nonprofit healthcare cooperatives fit into the medical landscape. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Here's a Food Friday follow-up. Last week, I talked to the author of the cookbook, Saucy. It was all about simple sauces to add new wrinkles to our everyday cooking. As I often do, I took something home. I tried it over the weekend. I made a version of the guest's comeback sauce, as in y'all come back now. She's a Southern cook. You can find that recipe at WPR.org/food. It's nothing fancy. Ketchup, mayo, mustard, Worcestershire sauce, a bunch of spices. I left out the fresh parsley because we didn't have any fresh parsley. Also calls for fresh garlic. I substituted some roasted garlic powder because the sauce wasn't going to have a long time to sit before we actually ate it. Fresh garlic sticks around for me a real long time. Like if I'd eaten it Saturday night, I'd probably still taste it right now. Even with the substitutions, it was a great dipping sauce for our quesadillas. You can find that recipe, try it yourself for comeback sauce and much more at WPR.org/food. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we get advice on how to get mental health care if you've never done it before. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Madison business owner. It's part of a series we're airing this month on women in southern Wisconsin in partnership with Midwest Mujeres.
Have you ever been on a trip that changed the course of your life? Catalina Sanchez of Madison has. She told me about this as part of a storytelling project with Midwest Mujeres in Madison. Sanchez has always been interested in art. Her mother noticed this early on. So when Sanchez was in middle school, her mom sent her to New York City to spend time with a friend who created large spray paint murals.
We had like about 3 murals that we had to work on. So we were taking places that were kind of vandalized, not very welcoming, like, you know, offensive words, that kind of thing. And we were making it into something beautiful. And I just thought it was so inspiring that, you know, you can take whatever you have and always make it better.
Sanchez would carry that inspiration with her through the rest of her teenage years, which weren't always easy for her. She wrote about it in an essay.
Unfortunately, I haven't always been proud to identify as Latina. Growing up, my biological father, who was Latino, wasn't in the picture, and it made it hard for me to understand my culture and be proud of it. Growing up, I felt that I never fit in anywhere. I didn't fit in with the Latinos at school. I was too white because I didn't speak Spanish or understand it.
Eventually, Sanchez dropped out of high school.
I just wasn't myself. I wasn't doing anything. I'm just someone who always needs to be doing something and be proud of myself.
So she went to Madison College and got her GED. When plotting her next move, Sanchez would reflect back on that trip to New York and how happy she was creating art. So she enrolled in elite nail school. Now she specializes in nail art, creating these colorful, detailed sets on tiny personal canvases.
So it took me a little bit to get the hang of it, but it's just something that I'm very passionate about and I love doing. It makes me feel good, makes my clients feel good. It's, you know, a way for people to express themselves.
Sanchez got a job in a high-end salon, but it wasn't a great fit. So she took a risk and opened her own business, Graffiti Nail Salon. The name, inspired by that life-changing trip to New York.
When I was working for a salon, I thought people were coming there because of the atmosphere. It was a very, like, high-end luxury salon. So when I went off to my own place, it was just like an office suite. It wasn't even like a salon-style suite, but it made me feel very good to know that people are coming to me because of me, and they like my work, and they know that I take pride in what I do.
And her favorite part of the job?
And I will say for me, not only is like empowering them through their nails and like making people feel better about themselves, but I also get to meet a lot of different people from all different stages and walks of life. I meet young people, I meet like older people, like I meet so many different people and they just teach me so many things about life.
A set of nails can take her hours, plenty of time to get to know her clients.
I actually do have a sign inside my salon that says, welcome to your therapy appointment, I mean nail appointment. Yes,
Sanchez says her evolution from insecure teen to business owner has been empowering.
Because I just feel like my identity has been something that I've always kind of struggled with. Now that I'm a little bit older, I really do take pride in being Latina. I think it is just being around other people who are comfortable with themselves and, you know, being in your community of people who are like you. When you're around a lot of negativity and people who don't want to see you do good in life, you start to believe those things as well. So just like finding my place and like a good group of people to be around has really helped me.
Catalina Sanchez shared her story with us as part of a partnership with Midwest Mujeres in Madison. We've partnered with the organization to share stories of women who live in southern Wisconsin. After I talked with Sanchez, her business, Graffiti Nail Salon, experienced a devastating fire. Everyone was safe, but she lost everything. She told me via email, though, that she's not letting the tragedy stop her from pursuing her dreams. Sanchez's community has helped her with supplies and a workspace until she finds a permanent location once again. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Central Time. Do you want to find mental health care, but looking for a therapist feels like climbing Mount Everest? If so, you're not alone. Research has found that people who would benefit from mental health care often don't get it. In part, that's because of stigma or a belief that it's not really necessary. In part, it's because people don't know where to start. There are also some big structural barriers to getting treatment. Many Americans live in places, for example, with a shortage of mental health care providers. Then there's paying for it. We're talking about how to find mental health care. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been seeking therapy or another form of mental health care? What barriers have you run into along the way? What sort of things have made the search challenging? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Karen Landman is a senior reporter at Vox covering public health. Before becoming a journalist, she trained as an epidemiologist and physician with specialties in internal medicine, pediatrics, and infectious diseases. Dr. Landman, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob. Great to be with you.
You wrote a guide for Vox on the basics of how to seek mental health care. You start with an example, your own. Can you talk about some of the things that kept you, when you wanted to, from seeking some mental health treatment?
I mean, I probably would have benefited from therapy beginning in my teens, but didn't really seek it out in a serious way until just a couple years ago. And I'm not going to give away my age, but much well out of my teens, let's say. And I think, you know, there were a number of barriers along the way. First, it just felt like I didn't have the coverage for it and it was too expensive out of pocket. And then, you know, in the medical field and for a time I was also in the public health service, which is a uniformed service, there were great disincentives to not get mental health care documented in your medical record. You then had to admit that you'd received it. And so there was both, you know, sort of a soft stigma, but also a very real disincentive to seek care. And then, you know, it just took me a while to get a job after that had great benefits, like the one I have now that pays pretty well for mental health care. So even once that happened and I found some recommendations of who to seek care from, I just didn't want to have that first conversation on the phone where I knew I was going to try talking about some of the challenges that I wanted help with. And it took me a long time to overcome all of that to actually get someone on the phone. Once I did, they were so understanding and it just felt like, God, why did I wait this long? So I have a lot of empathy for folks who take a while to get there.
And so you wrote this guide. Now, let's imagine someone out there, not in an emergency mental health situation, but with maybe an ongoing thought, something's not quite right. Maybe care could help. I have no clue. What would you recommend to them as a starting point?
So I think it really depends on what resources you already have at your disposal. If you don't have any healthcare providers at all, and you don't know anybody in the healthcare field, it can feel really daunting to put a name to what you're going through and put a name to the kind of help that you seek. Mm-hmm. And I just want to tell people that folks who provide mental health care don't expect the people who come to them seeking that care to know what they need. They are expert not only at providing the care that people need, but at helping people navigate the system and figure out what's right for them, whether it is a couple sessions of talking to somebody, whether it is a specific kind of therapy that lasts a few months to sometimes, you know, a year or more, whether you're somebody who might benefit from medication, whether other kinds of modalities like support groups or mutual aid or all kinds of other types of therapy are going to be useful in your life and dealing with the symptoms that you have. So I just would, I would hope to bring people a little bit of calm about the question whether they need to know what they need before they start seeking care. If you do have some healthcare at all, if you have a primary care doctor or anyone in healthcare that you know and trust, you can start by just speaking to that person and saying, you know, I feel like something's a little off for me. I'm having some differences in my mood that just are not the kinds of things that I have had in the past. I'm not enjoying things the way I once did. I'm having some other, you know, sleep problems or problems dealing with people who I love and care about in my life, trouble with work. Do you know what I might do for this? What kind of help I might need? You know, primary care providers are actually pretty experienced with providing some aspects of mental health care, with connecting people with therapists, with prescribing a lot of pretty common anti-anxiety and anti-depression medications and a variety of other mental health medications. So a primary care provider is a great place to start if you have one. But even if you don't, speaking to a provider that you see in an urgent care facility or an emergency room, sometimes they can set you on a path. But even if you don't have those pathways to accessing mental health, there's some really terrific websites and hotlines or warm lines that can get you on the right foot for finding care that works for you.
Now, supposing we do decide we want to work with a therapist, and as you say, we might not know exactly what we need, what specialties. It may feel weird, like, oh, do I have to commit to this person for the long run? How do we start to feel out if there's a good match, a good fit?
You mean with a therapist in particular?
Exactly.
Yeah. So I also want to just start by saying therapists don't expect you to match with them as sort of on the first, as your first try. They expect you to do a little bit of shopping around. And so you should expect to do that too. It's very reasonable. You're not violating any norms by speaking with a few therapists, maybe even having a couple of initial sessions before you decide whether somebody is a good fit for you. So you can start by just, if you have insurance coverage, seeing who is covered by your insurance. You can also ask for recommendations from people in your social network or from a healthcare provider. One of the therapists I talked to, one of the experts I talked to said, people are often really worried about being stigmatized and hesitate to tell people in their social networks that they're seeking mental health care. So sometimes you might, if that describes you, you may want to ask, someone I know, a friend is looking for a therapist. It seems like such an obvious trick, but you know, if you're worried about saying I'm looking for a therapist, that is one way to get over that hump. But once you do have a few names, whether from your insurance company or as recommendations, you can call them and just sort of feel out what kind of person they are. In the article that I wrote, there's a list of questions that you might try asking therapists to just get a feel for things like what types of clients they've worked with before, whether they've ever dealt with a client who's dealing with the things that you're dealing with. You can ask them about the approaches that they use in your therapy, and that may not mean anything to you at this stage, and that's okay. But sometimes therapists, you know, may have really specific ways that they like to help people. They may have specific populations they like to help or specific issues they like to help with, like grief or LGBTQ issues or, you know, aging issues. You can ask them how often they would meet with you, how long sessions last, what they would do if you were in crisis, how long they think you'll need treatment for. And all of those kinds of questions can really help you not only just get some answers to the questions that you actually have, but also get a sense with what it's like to interact with this person. Does the conversation flow easily? Do they seem happy to answer your questions and eager to make you feel comfortable? Or do you kind of get a weird vibe or feel hesitant to interact with them? So those sort of little warmer, you know, those softer signals can give you a real sense of how comfortable you're going to be talking about more challenging things with that person further on down the line.
Dr. Karen Landman is a senior reporter at Vox covering public health. Before becoming a journalist, she trained as a physician and epidemiologist. She's talking with us about how to get mental health care when you've never done it before. She wrote a guide at Vox.com. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've sought and received help or you're a provider, what advice would you give to people looking to go to maybe therapy for the first time? How did you find mental health care that was a good match for you? Or did you face some challenges as you tried to seek it out? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk about how to find mental health care. Our guest is Dr. Karen Landman, senior reporter at Vox covering public health, also trained physician and epidemiologist. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have any questions or advice about finding or affording therapy? How has therapy changed your life if you've had access to it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And hey, later on today, we're going to have a list of resources up at WPR.org/Central Time for communities around the state. Again, look for that this evening at WPR.org/Central Time. Dr. Landman, for people who don't have that insurance and are worried about high costs, what kind of advice do you have for them in seeking something that they can maybe afford?
Yeah, no, I can totally relate. And I will actually say the therapist that I started seeing a couple years ago is not actually the first therapist that I ever saw. I did very briefly in my 20s see a therapist who was getting their PhD and therefore seeing patients on a free basis as part of their own training. So that meant I was seeing someone who was basically practicing giving therapy. Our sessions were being observed by a professor of theirs. And so they were getting feedback after our sessions about how our sessions went. I actually found those sessions pretty helpful. I couldn't keep attending them because of the intensity of my schooling at the time, but I thought that was a great resource. And so that is one place you might want to start. If you're in a place where there is a school of psychology where people are training to be clinical psychologists, you can check and see if they're open to seeing you as a patient. There are probably some boundaries around that, but the school will tell you what those are. Also, some providers have sliding scale fees. So you can, if you have identified a few providers that you think you might want to see, you can ask them whether they do have sliding scale fees, which means that people who can afford only a lower cost for their therapy sessions may be allowed to pay that lower cost. There are lots of other ways to get therapy other than seeing a therapist one-on-one. There are support groups in lots of parts of the country, which are often free of charge. And those may be run out of healthcare centers, but there are also a lot of nonprofit organizations that run support groups. There are other kinds of community groups that may be called something like a mutual aid organization. Depending on whether you're dealing with specific issues, sometimes for addiction, obviously, I know a lot of us think about 12-step groups. Those are actually a great source for a lot of mental health support for a lot of people, but we may not be thinking of it that way. But those and many, many other mutual aid groups are free of charge. It's hard to know without consulting a resource what's in your area and what exactly might be right for you. And some of the resources that I mentioned in the story and that it sounds like you'll be sharing with your listeners, mm-hmm. like NAMI, National Association for Mental Illness, I mm-hmm. believe, and Mental Health America, both of those sites have resources that can help folks find support groups and mutual aid groups and other kinds of community care services where they can get support. And, some folks simply are just not that comfortable interacting with the healthcare system or with medical providers and really feel that these are not second string approaches to their mental health. They really want to get support from people in their community who really understand them in a deeper way than they feel healthcare may understand them. So I just want to be clear that even though these may be free of charge, many people find them immensely helpful and a really great source of support. So people may really want to look into them also as a way to save money.
Right, Dr. Landman, suppose somebody's been successful. They've redone their research, found a therapist that they're able to pay for them. Can you talk, give us some advice for that first conversation, how to establish what you're hoping to get out of working with the therapist? It may be a scary moment for people to open up in that way.
Yeah, I can imagine. So that first visit, you really want to be seeing how you interact with this person. Like, do you feel that you want to open up to this person? And you can get a sense for that whether you are seeing that person face-to-face, you know, in person, or if you're seeing them virtually online, both of which, by the way, are perfectly valid ways to receive therapy, talk therapy. So yeah, understanding that it can be uncomfortable to open up about really personal issues and hard things when you're speaking with somebody. See what it feels like to do that with this person. Do you feel supported? Do you feel held and seen? I mean this figuratively, right? Do you feel like this person is really holding space for you and seeing you for who you are and allowing you to really open up? You know, after the visit, you check in with yourself and you know, ask yourself, did you feel heard? Did it feel comfortable? And were you encouraged also to talk about what you want to get out of therapy? I think people have this fear that once I start therapy, I'm going to become a therapy person and be that person for the rest of my life. And I'm never going to be able to make a decision without a therapist, or I have to keep going to therapy. That's not at all the case. I think therapy is something to be thought of as a thing you can drop into when you need it, and something that you do not have to be in for the rest of your life at all. That, in fact, for many people, it's just something they need for a few months or a few years until they get through a hard time in their life. So, but you do want to have somebody who's happy to talk to you upfront about what you think you need and how long they think it's going to take to get that. So just don't be afraid to ask questions that help you get to those answers and to really check in with yourself and be honest with yourself about what the interaction and chemistry with that person feels like, and to shop around if you're not sure. You know, you may find after you speak with a couple other people that, yeah, I actually really did like the vibes I got from that first person I talked to better than I did the second and third. So I'm going to go back to that person. Or you may learn that actually you're looking for something different than you found in that first visit. So don't hesitate to shop around.
Dr. Landman, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks again for having me to talk about this really important issue.
Dr. Karen Landman is a senior reporter at Vox covering public health. Before becoming a journalist, she trained as an epidemiologist and physician. She talked to us about what to do when you're seeking mental health care. We'll have a list of mental health resources in Wisconsin coming up at WPR.org/Central Time later this evening. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, there's been a lot of focus lately on boosting technical skills in education to prepare people for the workforce. But are we forgetting the people stuff? A guest makes the case for more focus on the soft skills that we need at work. And as we just heard, mental health care can be hard to find. A new type of counseling is getting more attention. People call them lay therapists, with a narrower focus but possibly fewer credentials. We'll find out how it works and how it can be a piece, at least, of the overall puzzle. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.